other than obviously people who are in this industry,
yeah,
who the fuck knows this, right?
Yeah, you really don't. It's not something that most people think about.
Right, right.
Yeah.
But when you explain it, it makes total sense. Like,
in December, I was the guest on an episode of the Heuristics podcast hosted by Kobi Ben-Melech. Heuristics is about how humans interact with technology. For that full unedited episode of the Heuristics podcast, click on the link in the description down below. The next few episodes of the Business of Entertainment will be a mini-series of clips from the recording I did with Kobi, but I'll feature additional commentary both at the beginning and end of each of these episodes. In this episode specifically, I'll go over some of the aspects of shooting food commercials, the American Society of Cinematography and some of its members, the hierarchy of productions, and some on-set pranks. Now, I don't want to spoil this episode too much, but if you want to know how some people goof off on set, keep listening. Throughout this episode, though, I made a few mistakes. Without having another device with me to correct my mistakes, I had to just keep pushing through the conversation topics as accurately as I could remember. Feel free to add in the comments what was missing or what needs correcting. Enjoy.
When you're shooting a food commercial, you're not actually shooting the real food. You're shooting something that looks like food.
Huh?
You didn't know this?
No.
Oh, yeah. So ice cream is actually, it's not ice cream. It's actually flour or some sort of like potato flour.
What?
That's colored and balled up. Or it could be Play-Doh as well. Ice cubes are not ice cubes. What they are, it's a glass filled with plastic cubes. And then you can put glycerin on the side of the glass to make it look like it's sweaty. There's a really fascinating cinematographer. His name is Bill Bennett. That could, if you were to Google search Bill Bennett, mm-hmm. Budweiser commercial. I want to say it's Budweiser. Bill, sorry if I'm wrong on Budweiser.
Mm-hmm.
He explicitly only does commercial photography. And if you were to see, I'm sure there's some behind the scenes stuff as to that I've seen. I've seen some of the behind the scenes things in his. I don't know where you can find them all, but some of the things that he's explained to film students behind the scenes of what he's been doing when he's doing it. It's pretty fascinating to hear about the thought process that goes into how just to display like one single product shot. Like the whole 15-second commercial sometimes might just boil down to whether or not they like it based on like a half a second of like the hero shot of what something's supposed to look like.
Whoa.
Yeah.
What's wrong with filming the actual food? Why not just do that?
A friend to Bill Bennett, David Darby, ASC. David Darby has been like a mentor of mine for a long time. And he was telling me, he was like, do you understand how hard it is that he was doing a car commercial or practicing for something for a car commercial? He's like, do you understand how hard it is to get a Ferrari on a 360 spinning wheel to be in the exact same position, like dead center based on the car center so that the entire car stays in focus while you're trying to film it? I was like, no, but it sounds complicated. You have to drive it forward and backwards. He's like, no. It's a 1/8 scale replica. He's like, we're not working with real Ferraris, or not 1/8 and one, maybe 1/16. They're working with models.
But like miniature models.
Miniature models. No, he was for that day. He was talking to me. I believe it was a Ferrari. I don't remember if he's shooting a Ferrari commercial, if he was testing something.
What?
But think about it like this. If you don't need to shoot the real thing, why are you shooting the real thing? Like, why? Like, how long can you keep meat hot and fresh for? How long can you keep your glass chilled for? You have to design things around that. And then light it with intent for what it is you're trying to convey to your audience.
Okay.
So like and one of the trickiest things is actually vehicles. Like Bill Bennett and David Darby ASC. Bill Bennett ASC, David Darby ASC.
What is ASC?
American Society of Cinematography.
Yeah. Why do you keep saying that?
You're supposed to.
Jesus, okay.
It's like, all right, so you know, like, if I was to say Patrick Stewart, it's more proper to say Sir Patrick Stewart.
Okay.
Do you know?
Okay. No, I know who he is.
Yeah.
He's been knighted.
Sir Elton John.
I mean, I just say Elton John.
I understand. So
Spotify, put on Elton John. Anyway, go on.
The ASC, mm-hmm. the American Society of Cinematographers, mm-hmm. is an organization dedicated to the advancement of cinematography.
Yeah.
From a technical perspective and a storytelling perspective, mm-hmm. over their 104 years in existence, based on the time of this recording, mm-hmm. they have had just over 600 members only. It's a pretty exclusive club to be in.
What? What? Why?
It's basically the elite of the elite of cinematographers.
Okay.
And you can learn a lot. If you were to search, if anybody listening wants to find out more about cinematography, read the ASC handbook. It is an 800 page manual just about cinematography.
Wow.
And it goes into the very technical specifics. And at the end, there are appendices that literally talk about lens correction, color correction. So like if you're doing something on set and you're using this, you can look in the appendix of what you're trying to correct for, and it will give you mathematical formulas for like, you should take a look at that.
Holy shit. It might
not be exactly what you want, but that ASC manual is a very, very helpful thing.
Wow. But okay, but why is it so elitist?
It's such
a blue collar.
I wouldn't say that it's elitist. I'd say it's
600 people of over 100 years.
In my opinion.
Yeah.
And I'm not a member.
So yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah.
But from my perspective, I don't think it's elitist in terms of who you are, because you're brought in based on the recommendation of somebody else, and that your body of work is judged against your peers to be able to bring you into
Bill
Bennett and David Darby, when they're filling a car,
yeah,
the biggest thing with a car, like when you put it, like when you turn on your flashlight and you look into a mirror, there's a big spot right in the middle where your flashlight is, right?
Okay.
Same thing with cars. When they're filming a car and they have one light, like that one, pointing at a car, it's going to be reflected just off of that one spot of the car. So how do you light for a whole car to be able to not have those individual spots? When you need lighting, that is about twice the length of the car,
right,
and is a single light source.
Therefore, you need the miniature models.
You need miniature models, or you need literally gigantic 60-foot light sources, like pieces of fabric. Mm-hmm. There are some companies called, I want to say the Rag House? I'm butchering their name. Based out of Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm.
And they can build you like a 60-foot wide by 30-foot high white piece of fabric that you could just shine light through to be able to create one big gigantic light source with zero stitching in between. It's like literally a 30 by 60 piece of fabric.
Whoa.
With no stitching in the middle so that the light source is even. So when you get up to full size vehicles or full size products like that, that are that big, you need absolutely massive amounts of light. And you need it from massive amounts of, like, a massive size of the light.
So what? So car commercials. So the two possibilities, right? Because you said that the car companies spend a fuck ton of money on advertisements. And so maybe they use this super fancy technology and therefore can just sort of digitize their commercials. Or they use just miniature models to... Which one is it exactly?
They use a combination of both. And then there's some commercials that are literally the whole car the whole time, a real car. And some of them, some other commercials are just 100% virtual with nothing done in person. It's all done on computers.
That's so wild, man. Like, imagine, you're trying to entice people to buy whatever product you're trying to sell.
Mm-hmm.
And the product that you're looking at isn't the thing that you're being enticed to buy to begin with. So weird.
with marketing, you're trying to build an audience and engage your audience and build a relationship with them. I don't think that so many people expect exactly what they see on their phone or TV to literally look exactly 100% shiny and the exact same shininess as what they see in real life versus the screen. If it's close enough and you got good marketing and you can get good salespeople to help sell your product, it's a whole big circle for that, from that aspect. If you're talking about specifically having a product that needs to be sold. It's about building brand awareness, engaging your audience, creating a relationship, and building a community around it to help drive your company
forward. Yeah. I mean,
I
could see the point. I could see the point, like, for example, with food, right? If it looks if it looks close enough to the real thing,
yeah,
it's not really the look that you're after, it's the taste.
Correct.
Right? And that you can't capture in images.
There are some TVs out of Japan that have smells that are reproduced.
What? How does that even work?
I don't know. It's so weird. I was watching a video about it going, I really want to try it. But at the same time, it's like, you can't recreate grandma's kitchen. You can't.
Right.
There's just some things that you just, you'll never hit the, and you can get close. But like trying to mix, I mean, you can make, you know, you can make colognes, perfumes, things like that.
Stuff that's mass produced, you can.
Yeah.
I mean, it all smells the same, right?
Yeah, but there was a TV that was made in Japan, or maybe it was China, that was specifically had a, it was like Smell-O-Vision TV. This was pretty recent, within the past few years.
No way, man.
Never really took off, but yeah, they did it. But yeah, with food, it's about, think about the lights. So like Arri or even their competitor, Mole Richardson.
Mm-hmm.
Mole Richardson has been doing film lights for a very long time, specifically also TV and film lights. They're like that. They're huge in that area. And when you, let's say you have ice cream and you want to photograph ice cream in a commercial and it's taking a half hour to get the shot set up. Well, when your ice cream starts melting, the reflection of the lights are going to be different off the ice cream because your ice cream is melting.
Mm.
So it's like, what do you do to make your ice cream not melt? Well, you need to come up with a way to make something look like ice cream. That's not ice cream.
Mm-hmm.
Food specifically, there's a huge industry behind that dedicated just to figuring out what the product looks like as it's going to be filmed and how you're going to light it. And lighting gets real specific with commercials like that. Very specific. There are very detailed conversations with a lot of heads about, I like the lighting like over here, but then this one spot, and I'm not sure. It's like, listen, they're the ones paying the bill. They're the ones paying the bill, and they're the ones that are hiring you to do this. So, I mean, if you don't want to work with them, you don't have to.
No, I know.
It's
wild. Who other than obviously people who are in this industry?
Yeah.
Who the fuck knows this, right?
Yeah, you really don't. It's not something that most people think about.
Right.
Yeah.
But when you explain it, it makes total sense. Like, let's say I'm filming a commercial about hamburgers. I mean, how many patties am I gonna get until I get the right shot of the thing coming off the grill with the the juices flying around? You'll need to take, I don't know, at least 20 patties, maybe more. I have no idea, right? I don't know how many of these takes you need, but, or you could just get something that's reusable and more or less looks like it, and that's it. You know?
Yes.
Much cheaper, much easier.
There's, I saw this thing. I think it was on LinkedIn. I could look for it and send it to you. There was a behind the scenes of this one company that just does food commercials.
Yeah.
And I believe it was in the UK. I think that's what I was looking at.
Wow.
It was in the UK. And I could hear about the set designer was like, okay, so we have this kitchen that, or we have this rest, we're supposed to be in a restaurant. And
yeah.
Like, well, she would just go and buy something for this production that could then be reused on a whole nother production.
Yeah.
And they have to build the environment around of what it's going to be and what the lighting's going to look like in there. And it's a real, the food commercial industry is, if you're good at the high end, you're working with multi-million dollar commercials over a hamburger. So the money can be there. But at the same time, you're going to be working with like the most detailed oriented people and specific people, people who specifically want specific things and are paying you to do that. So it might go against your creative vision, depending on what they're looking, what they want versus what you think is a cool idea.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, they're the client and you have to respect what they want.
Right. Wow. Who knew, man?
And all of this that I've learned all came from just working in lighting.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I just wanted to learn more. I just wanted to understand more. And then, like, I got to a point where I don't have any work. I got to go make more money. So then I started working in these different environments, yeah. Like I said earlier, that gave me a better perspective on it's what you do on a small show is what you do on a big show. And just because it might be live here or pre-recorded here or commercial over here, it's really similar. You got people who have money that want something made, and you have creative people that can do it, and there's logistics about how to do it. And
yeah.
The hierarchy, there's a hierarchy. I told you, remember I talked to you about the director, then the first AD, second AD, second sec?
Yeah.
There's a hierarchy on set where understanding who to talk to about what's going on. If the director's in the middle of trying to block a scene and you have a question that they don't need to answer right now because they're very busy, who do you ask that question to?
Okay.
Do you ask it to your department head? Do you ask it to possibly somebody else? And who would that somebody else be? Like, understanding the hierarchy and respecting that hierarchy, I feel, is something that anyone who gets into this industry, as you would ask, like talked about before, needs to understand. And if you break that hierarchy, you need to know why. Like, the rules, like they say, rules are meant to be broken, or like filming rules. There's a rule in film where you don't break 180 degrees. So
what?
Exactly. It's the 180 degree rule. So I'm filming you from here. We all know that you're here looking this way. Okay. And then all of a sudden we go from the other side of you looking this way. It's like, why did we do that? That's very like jarring to the audience from a lighting perspective, from like a perspective on screen. So right now you're on the right side, and that from the other side, you'd be on the left and we're looking over your shoulder. There's instances when you can break that rule. Let's say you're shooting a car that's supposed to be driving, that's actually on a racetrack and is going 250 miles an hour, like a Bugatti, all right? Everybody knows, no matter what angle you shoot that car from, it goes, if all of a sudden you're on the side and it goes, and then you're behind it, following it, and then you come in front of it and it goes past you, everybody knows it's going that way. Mm-hmm. There's no confusion that the action is taking you that way.
Mm-hmm.
So there's certain, like that 180 degree rule, you can break it. Is why. So same thing with hierarchy on a set. If you're going to break that hierarchy, why are you going to?
Sounds like fertile ground for pranks.
It is. Oh my God. Yes. Oh my goodness.
So yeah, go ask the director. He's fine. He's cool.
So do you know? Okay. So we've got the audio device here and then the video device there synced mm-hmm. with the audio mix.
Mm-hmm.
Imagine if that got out of the video and audio got out of sync on that ATEM, you would need a way to resync it, right?
Okay.
So, you know, at the beginning of a shot, they have that clapper, like take one, action.
Yeah.
Okay. So, something you can do to rookies, and I don't recommend this unless you actually know your whole crew and know that you yourself won't get fired for telling a rookie to do this. And also, if you do this on a set, you have to realize you're going to now spend like 2 minutes out of a day where people are, you know, how many people are on set that you're paying hundreds of dollars per day? How much does each minute cost? Mm-hmm. So if you screw up the day because you're trying to be funny, if it's a new guy who doesn't know and you put him into that position and that screws up our day, I would have a talking to the guy that told him about it. I would tell that rookie and be like, dude, don't even worry about it. Wasn't your fault. You didn't know. But this is what it's called. It's called middle sticks.
Okay.
So in between takes. Wow. Before the take comes to an end, while the actors are still going, have a rookie run into the scene and just start going with the clacker and you say, middle sticks. and start clacking the, thing together.
Oh, no.
Oh, shout out to Scottsdale Community College Film School for that one.
But that must be a known thing.
Thanks, like, guys.
Like, if veteran actors all of a sudden see some random person like, middle sticks, like, okay.
It depends on someone's who you're fucking working with. I hope that someone have good enough sense to know to not go in there. But if, like, let's say you're a department head. If you're a department head and you have a rookie go interrupt what could have been a good take.
Ooh.
Yeah. And especially, remember, you're shooting. Now we have data cards, so you can erase something. But when you were shooting on film. Yeah. And let's say it's like a 5-minute shot.
Yeah.
You know how much 5 minutes of film cost?
Oh, wow. Okay.
Not cheap.
Wow.
Yeah.
So no wonder these sets are such charged. They can be such charged environments.
They can be, but they can be great environments. I think charged in a good way. When we do something here that I have the opportunity to help out on because it's an internal project,
yeah.
I try to make sure that everybody, first off, here's how I want there to be high energy. I always want high energy. I don't want people to come in and have low energy.
Mm.
I've got a big speaker that I start playing music on. I like to be the first one here. I get music going. I open up the studio. And my priorities for the day are we doing it safe? Because if it's not safe, we stop and fix. Rule number one. So are we doing it safe? Are we having fun? Because if we're not having fun, like, why are you here if this is, like, unbelievably exhausting?
Mm.
And then are we getting what we need to... Are we shooting and getting what we need to shoot and get?
Yeah.
And I put fun above that because if you have a bad attitude, if you have a grumpy attitude, like, some people might have... There have been instances that you could find on the internet of, like, celebrities flipping out on someone from behind the scenes.
Yeah.
And so I'll listen to some of those tapes, and sometimes they're justified because, like, the person on behind the scenes is doing something that is bringing down the energy of the whole room or interrupting takes when they shouldn't be, and they should know better. So, because if you're safe and you're having fun, you're going to love making, you're going to dedicate the hell out of getting, like at the beginning, I talked about ownership of work and being able to be a part of that, even a little cog in that wheel, being a part of what's going on the screen.
Yeah.
And it translates well to good takes, I think. I feel that the audience, will notice that subconsciously.
Yeah.
Like I said before. So yeah, I put, that's the order I put it in.
In this episode, I briefly mentioned the ASC. And if you want to learn more about lighting and camera for cinema, there are few other places in the world to go and learn so much. But the ASC is definitely at the top of my list. In 2013, when I was still new to lighting, I got the opportunity to attend an ASC master's class at the ASC, where I learned how to really level up my skills. I specifically mentioned two members of the ASC who have had a strong influence on my skill set. Depending on what you want to focus on for lighting or camera, there are several other amazing cinematographers and lighting designers whose bodies of work will teach you how to rethink what is possible for your storytelling needs. For me personally, the people whose bodies of work have had the most impact on me are cinematographers David Darby, ASC, Diane Beebe, ASC, as well as lighting designers Dakar Azulay, Gil Amir, Richard Kadena, and Jeff Ravitz. Let me know down below in the comments if you have a list of mentors whose bodies of work that inspire you. Thanks again for joining me on this mini-series about lighting and camera. I hope that these episodes have had an impact on you. Please don't forget to like, and subscribe. See you in the next episode. Ciao!